podcast from AusCert's 2009 conference is brought to you by Microsoft. For full risky business coverage of AusCert, point your browser to risky.biz.
Risky Business 2 is proud to present, for your listening pleasure, Peter Gutman's Day 2 keynote to the AusCert Security Conference on the Gold Coast. Peter's a great speaker, so enjoy his keynote.
So the reason, the sort of thinking behind this was that we've got this multi-billion dollar global industry, which is cybercrime. There's some figures there, so no one knows where those figures came from. But, you know, I assume people can agree that it is a serious problem. On the other hand, we've got encryption and digital signatures and CAs and security technology and firewalls and all this stuff. Why do we have all this cool security technology and yet at the same time this multi-billion dollar global crime industry? So here's some background information. This is, you know, if you read any security textbook, you'll find this sort of stuff. This, you know, you've got certain security services you need, confidentiality, integrity, availability, that sort of thing. And then there's a whole lot more. There's authentication and non-repudiation and this endlessly long list depending on which textbook you read. And again, Computer Security 101, this is a kind of a standard attack model. It's a passive attacker. So when security geeks talk about communicating parties, it's always Alice and Bob talking to each other. And then you have various interlopers and things attacking them. Like if there's an eavesdropper, it's always someone called Eve. So this is a more extended model of that. So this is an active attack. You've got a guy called Mallet, which is a malicious adversary. And they're going in and they're modifying packets and doing mail spoofing and other stuff like that. So this is very basic stuff. For the people at the back who can't sort of see the stuff at the bottom, what it says is if you keep saying, "Bear with me for a moment," when you show people random slides, then it takes them a long time to realize that you are just showing them random slides. But, you know, this is relevant. Bear with me for a moment. So basically, here's the summary. You've got your communicating parties, Alice and Bob. You've got Eve, your eavesdropper. There's things like Peggy and Victor, which is for digital signatures. Peggy is the prover, Victor is the verifier. You've got Trent, your trusted arbitrator. In PKI terms, that's the CA, and so on and so forth. So that's all the textbook security stuff. There's something missing from this picture, which is, you know, Bob the botnet, Peggy the fisher, Vic the virus. You don't find any of this kind of stuff in conventional security thinking or security theory. It's basically someone else's problem. We don't worry about that stuff because it's really hard. And you've got the same duality for other security models, like there's AAA, Authentication, Authorization, and Accounting, and occasionally you see a fourth one mentioned called Auditing. And there's problems with that as well. The thing is, this is really, really uninteresting. If you think of the canonical, boring person, it's an accountant. You know, if you've got some comedy or something and you want to have someone that's portrayed as being boring, it's an accountant. And it's the same thing with security technology. Accounting is really, really boring. For auditing, you turn on logging and that's it. You've got auditing enabled. Actually, can I get a quick show of hands? How many people here have heard of any of SSL, SSH, PGP, SMIME, IPsec, any of that? Show of hands. Anyone who doesn't have their hand up right now, you're at the wrong conference. You should be outside playing golf. So compare this. How many people have heard of RSC 2903, generic AAA architecture? Anyone? One person. Okay. And that gives you an idea of these kind of level of interest in auditing and accounting and stuff like that versus the really cool stuff, which is the encryption. So one of the very first internet payment systems was a system called First Virtual, and this was in about 94, 95, so pretty much predating browsers and SSL. It had two really interesting characteristics. The first one was that it was pretty much immune to all of the current phishing attacks. So this is a 15-year-old technology, and it's pretty much immune to all the current attacks we're seeing in terms of phishing and so on. The other thing that was interesting about it is it used no cryptography whatsoever. Zero-bit encryption, no digital signatures, no encryption, nothing. What the guys who designed this did is they looked at it and said that what counts is the auditing and the accounting and the authorization and so on and so forth. We don't need encryption for all of this. It just gets in the way. And so they got the auditing and so on right. And because of that, yeah, you had this zero-bit encryption technology that could have defeated most of the current phishing attacks. Having said that, you can still get around it with an awful lot of effort, but certainly it's nothing like the current avalanche of phishing we're getting. And in that case, though, you've got these relatively unloved security mechanisms. Even in this case, you can still defeat them. For example, authentication, okay, you've got Trojan horses, and they bypass standard authentication methods. For authorizations, you've got rootkits and zero-day, that sort of thing. Again, it bypasses that. For accounting, you use botnets, and so you don't know exactly where this is coming from, so your accountability goes away. And the neat thing about, neat for the attackers, I guess scary for the defenders, is that the attackers never sat down and read RFC 2903 and then figured out how we're going to bypass this. They simply looked at the problem and said, how do we do an end run around all this stuff? So the defenders basically said, you know, here's some encryption, we'll throw encryption at the problem, and that's it. whatever the problem was, we've just solved it. The attacker said, here is a problem. What specifically do we do to solve this problem, at least a problem for the attackers? So this is a traditional attacker threat model. You've got this lone hacker sitting in a basement and they're throwing different passwords at a login prompt. That's kind of the sort of thing that we're defending against with a lot of the security technology we use. This really is very 1980s, unless you're Twitter, in which case you are vulnerable to dictionary attacks because you don't rate limit the password guesses. So, and this actually happened in case if people missed that. Someone just went to Twitter, threw a dictionary at the login prompt, eventually got an administrator password, and then it was game over. So again, here's some of the defenses. This is the Orange Book, the stuff that the Orange Book is defending against. So this is basically a Trojan copy program. You execute the copy command, and it copies your password file out somewhere else. It's incredibly primitive. You know, you can detect it by basic inspection. You can prevent it through execution path control, so you make sure that you're executing the genuine copy command rather than the fake one, and so on and so forth. Here again is this FIPS 112. This is a security standard, US government standard. Lots of other governments follow the US government's lead in this. This was current until 2008. So this is their idea of a man-in-the-middle attack. So what you do is you've got a mainframe and you've got a terminal connected to this mainframe, and you get a hobbyist computer and build it into a briefcase and then plug it into the connection between the mainframe and the terminal that people are using. This was current until 2008. So that was the threat model that was being used in a standard that was current until last year. So this is what the Russians are doing. I'm not going to go through this, but basically this is driving the entire browser from the inside, so they're entering keystroke commands and mouse clicks and so on and so forth to take money out of your account and move it into something else. And this defeats pretty much any existing authentication method because we simply weren't expecting that level of attack. Here's another example. This is a couple of years old, but it's a relatively well-known one, Sergozy Trojan. And what this does is it bypasses SSL and Internet Explorer. So it registers itself as a Windows layered service provider, which goes down at the networking level. And then it's got the Gozy main server. It has bank-specific profiles. So it says you're going to, let's say, some particular bank. It fetches data from that, sends it to the main Trojan, which injects it through Internet Explorer. The service provider underneath intercepts that data and sends it back to the main Gozy Trojan. If what it gets back is the same as what it sent in, it knows that it can effectively bypass SSL. And from then on, whenever you do your banking, the layered service provider picks out all your banking details and sends it out to Russia. This is incredibly sophisticated. This isn't just, you know, a short script. This is actually code that verifies and tests itself to make sure that it's working. There are others that send out diagnostic memory dumps. So they run on a machine, it crashes. They send out a diagnostic memory dump to the people who wrote it so they can fix it up and send an improved version that will work the next time. It's like Windows error reporting. And, you know, just for comparison, we're defending against that sort of thing. And on the other hand, we've got the Russians doing that stuff. And you really can't do much against these things. It's a level of attack that we simply weren't expecting. So, you know, here's an example of defending where the attacker isn't. This is the reference model for internet user authentication. You've got your shared mainframe or mini computer. You've got ASR33 teletypes. It's in a shared terminal room, and people sit down at these teletypes, and they type in their session, and their password, in theory, gets printed on the teletype. And from this reference model in the previous slides, you can see the various password best practices. You can't write them down. They have to meet complexity requirements. They can't be shared. They have to be blanked on entry. They have to be changed regularly, and so on and so forth. So again, the reference model, as I said, you've got the single mainframe computer, shared terminals in a terminal room, and you've got teletypes that print stuff out. So for example, here's one of the threats. If someone walks into this room and they walk up to this Model 33 teletype and they tear off the old printout, your password's printed on that. So the requirement is you blank the password so it's not on the teletype. And even if you're a really modern mainframe shop, you've got a CRT terminal. And even those, they're 24x80, it takes a while for the password to scroll off the screen. So again, you have to blank your passwords so that someone walking up behind you in the shared terminal room can't see your password. Another thing that we do, no one actually knows why we do this. You have to change your password regularly. There have been attempts to find out. Gene Spafford sort of researched this in some detail, and as far as he could tell, there was some work done on a US mainframe in the 1960s which showed that if you use the entire mainframe to brute force a password, you can do it in a couple of months. And so, you know, the rule is change your password at least once a month based on this 1960s US Department of Defense mainframe threat model. So here's a bit of a digression. If no one knows why we change the passwords, why do we get 3 tries? Why don't we get 5? Why don't we get 8 or whatever? It's actually based on a sort of Hindu mythology, the Hindu Trimurti of Rama, Vishnu, and Shiva. Not a lot of people know that, but that's why we do it. Again, password complexity. There were concerns about wordless-based attacks. So, you know, with a Twitter attack, you throw a dictionary at the login prompt and see if you get in. So the response was password complexity rules. And everyone loves these. Managers like them. They can say we're following best practices. Admins like them. They click on the windows, you know, passwords must meet complexity requirements, and that's it. Their job's done. And geeks like them because you can do all these complicated mathematical formulas showing how wonderful they are. And this is a really good set of defenses against attackers from the 1960s. So here's some examples. Again, the standard FIPS 112, valid until last year. And so this contains detailed guidelines for things like passwords printed on teletypes that you're using to talk to your computer. CRT-based terminals I've mentioned. Things like passwords on punched cards. So again, this was a standard until last year. This works better if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof. So let's look at a couple of these things and see what we're actually buying for all this stuff. So complexity rules. These are basically arbitrary mathematical formula. You say they have to meet this formula. If they don't fall within the bounds of that formula, then they're no good. So, you know, that's a diagram of some of the passwords that are actually used. So the big one there is all passwords that are used in practice that are actually, you know, currently used with systems today. A subset of those passwords that are being used are bad passwords. And then the complexity rules just take an arbitrary byte out of that entire space. Because it is an arbitrary mathematical formula. So they knock out some bad passwords, they inadvertently knock out a number of very good passwords, and they do nothing at all in that gap down the bottom, which is just random gibberish passwords that no one uses anyway. So it's basically just purely coincidence that they chop out this chunk of stuff. So here's some examples of passwords from actual phishing data. This is from MySpace. Phishers collected passwords, 2 gigabytes worth of stuff, and these are the top 20 passwords. Or another way of looking at this is these are the 20 worst passwords you can possibly use because the phishers know these, or sorry, the attackers know these, and these are the ones they're going to try first. You may be able to guess the complexity rules that were used. Some of these predate the change in the complexity rules, but it was 6 characters and 1 digit. And as I said, there's 4 passwords there that predate the complexity rules, which is why they don't meet the rules. And you can see the effect of putting in arbitrary complexity rules like this, that you get a standard password and the value 1 after the end of it. So let's evaluate these passwords. NIST has a newer standard covering passwords, Special Publication 863, and it defines three strengths for passwords. There's a kind of an implicit level 0, which is fail, level 1 that says it's moderate strength, and level 2 that says it's high strength. And these are these complicated complexity rules saying whether it's a good password or not. Every single password in that list of the 20 worst passwords you can use counts as both a level 1 and level 2, like in other words, a moderate and strong strength passwords based on the NIST complexity requirements. So the 20 worst passwords you can use are regarded as strong by these arbitrary requirements. The pathologically worst case example I could find of a strong password is, a moderate strength password is A1, which is a brand of a popular steak sauce in the US. There's several rules that interact with each other, and so you get these incredibly weak passwords like A1 that are actually counted as being strong. So let's look at this as a psychology experiment. I've done some talks before on sort of psychology, so it's kind of an interest of mine. So let's say you're an experimental psychologist, which is not the guy with a funny accent and a couch, but someone who does experiments to see how people think and why they do certain things. So imagine you're an experimental psychologist, and you've been told, use your knowledge of psychology to design an experiment into induced amnesia. So there are 5 things you can do. The first one is you require that people memorize meaningless strings. And this is a standard technique in experimental psychology. Usually it's 3 characters or something like that. It's very short strings, but okay, meaningless strings. Second one is you never display the strings to them. If you can't visualize something, it's very, very hard to actually memorize it without visualization. You don't allow them to write it down. Memory aid, write it down. You're not allowed to do that. You blast loud music at them so it distracts them while they're trying to memorize it. And you force them to change the values as soon as there's a chance that they've actually memorized them. So how do best practices stack up? We've got almost all of them. It could also be argued that what the loud noise does is it creates stress. If you're logging onto a machine and you want to do your job and you're told you can't do your job, you have to come up with a password, that also creates stress. So we've almost got the fifth one as well. So let's say we've got 4.5 out of 5 of what an experimental psychologist would do to ensure that you can't remember passwords. Here's another way of looking at this. Let's say you're an experienced user and you've got passwords on blogs and all sorts of other stuff. So all you've got to do in that case is memorize that. And you've got to rememorize it every 30 days when it gets changed. And here's some real-world data. I won't go through this. You can probably imagine where this is leading. So here's some real-world data on this, which I'll skip through because it's not that interesting. But you know, let's look at a specific example of what some of this stuff does. I haven't mentioned this one yet, but there's session timeouts for passwords. And again, there's the reference model. The reason why we have session timeouts is that if you're in a shared terminal room, you walk away from your terminal. Someone else walks up to it, and they use your still-logged-on account. So on the one hand, you've got overly aggressive timeouts, which kick you out before you want to be kicked out. You've got a slow server, anything like that, you've got to re-enter all your data. And I've talked to the revenue people, and they've said, you know, we specifically do not have any timeouts on any of our servers, because if there's one thing people hate more than filling out a tax return, it's filling out the same tax return three times in a row. So, you know, you've got to be very careful with that. On the other hand of the scale, it's infrequent enough to be of any use. A typical home user, who are you protecting them against? Unless the cat's learned to type, you're not actually serving any useful purpose. But, you know, let's see how far we can actually chase this thing down the rabbit hole. So there's been studies done of real-world users, and they showed, in the case of this particular study, that 93% of users logged out after they had done online banking. Beyond that, users shut down the browser or used something like Firefox's clear private data and so on and so forth. So it was actually pretty close to 100% of people log out or clear everything after they've done online banking. So it's a minuscule number of users who do this anyway. But again, let's take an extreme example, an internet cafe. So this is almost a shared terminal room. If you've never used one of these things, you pay for a block of time, like 15 to 30 minutes or whatever, and you're forcibly logged out when your time's up. So generally people use up their time. They've paid for it. They're going to use it up no matter what, and they're just going to browse rubbish because they've paid for it and they want to get their money's worth. But then again, you know, let's look at the tiny fraction of people who go to internet cafes to do their online banking, pay for a lot of time and don't use it, and then don't log out when they leave. We've actually identified the user who does this. His name's Bob. So let's see what happens to Bob. There's two possible scenarios. First of all, the cafe isn't busy. If it's not busy, no one walks up to use the machine. You're forcibly logged out anyway, so nothing happens. If the cafe is busy and there's people queuing up to use the machines, as soon as you get up, someone else is going to sit down at your logged-on session. So unless you've got a 30-second timeout, it's not going to do any good. And either way, session timeouts don't really have much effect. In the worst case, you're denial of service. In the best case, they're really not doing that much good. So in 2005, I think it was at this conference, a Microsoft security strategist, Jesper Johansson, suggested that users choose, or alternatively, the site assigns them good passwords and they write them down. And other people suggested this as well. And, you know, I recommend this as well. It's a good idea. Actually, a better idea is to use a password manager, because the one thing that computers are good at is managing lots of meaningless data, which is what password managers do. The reactions to this were kind of scary. If you go and read through all the blogs and stuff where this was discussed, the reactions were kind of predictable. You know, there's the knee-jerk. What would Microsoft know about security? There was the usual suspects. We need to educate users. Yeah, that's going to work. Silver bullets. We need trusted computing, PKI, biometrics, whatever. And then the really scary ones, there were a number of responses like this. You know, I'm an auditor for my company, and in my organization, if anyone even thinks of writing down a password, we take them outside and we shoot them. And that was a really scary response that, you know, this is the sort of thing we're trying to build security around, so there's not much sign of these things moving out of the 1960s. And some thoughts on password usage and so on and so forth. So another example of defending where the attacker isn't is browser certificates. And these have virtually, well, you know, we've got this global phishing industry and the attackers don't really notice it. So just in case you missed that, there's the attack, phishing, and over there is the defense, browser certificates, nowhere near where the attackers are going in. You may have heard of this thing called EV certificates. So what this does is we'll defend twice as hard over here when no one's attacking, and the phishers will still keep coming in over there. But hey. And you can see this, the anti-phishing working group published statistics on phishing. And in the 12-month period over which these were rolled out, so starting from, you know, no support, then IE, then Firefox, and then, you know, yeah, full support for EV certificates, there was no effect whatsoever on phishing. So these had zero effect from the APWG statistics, which are, you know, they collect statistics from a lot of sources. There's a great quote there from a financial cryptographer in the UK saying that it's, yeah, doing more of what we've already discovered doesn't work. So this had already been determined experimentally. Before they were even deployed, some usability researchers went out and did a paper on this, an evaluation of extended validation. So it was known, I mean, first of all, to HCI people, it was kind of obvious that it wasn't going to work anyway. They'd looked at the effect of certificates and studied them. There's a huge number of studies on these. I've got some references towards the end if you really want to go through them all. But, you know, they evaluated the stuff and found that it doesn't work. So you'd think, didn't the people involved in creating these things check? Well, actually they did. VeriSign's marketing arm convened a focus group, and they exposed them to advertising for EV certificates. And they found that their customers or potential customers responded very positively to EV certificate advertising. So you can't claim the CAs didn't very thoroughly investigate the bits that mattered to them. Will people buy these things? Yeah, of course they'll buy them. So, you know, this is basically a PKI Mihara solution. Why was this even adopted? Well, if you look at the group that was pushing it, it was something called the CA Browser Forum. So okay, we've got this PKI and it doesn't work. We'll ask the CAs what they can do to, you know, fix this problem. Well, the problem for the CAs was that there's cheap certificates. You can get free certificates or $9.95 certificates. This is a problem. So we'll roll back to $500 certificates and the CAs have then fixed their problem. So, you know, the threat was cheap certificates. The response was premium-priced EV certificates. This is VeriSign's, it's called a CPS certificate practice statement, which, don't try and read that. This describes the terms under which certificates are issued and the verification and checking they do. One of these is the very first 1.0 from 1996, which was supposed to protect us in 1996. The other one is the EV certificate one from 2008. And if you distill down the legalese, they're basically exactly the same thing. So EV certificates are trying to roll back the clock to 1996 and, yeah, as Ian Gregg said, doing more of what we already know doesn't work. But there's a nasty downside of this. If you've used any of the newer versions of browsers, you'll notice EV certificates. I use Firefox, so in Firefox there's this green bar on this. And all the other stuff that was present with the older certificates, changing the URL bar and a bunch of other things, have all gone away because you've got to make EV certificates stand out. And to do that, you have to downgrade the existing certificates so that the newer, more expensive ones stand out. So this is a nasty side effect in that, again, if you used Firefox 3 and newer versions of IE, previously, you just get this dialogue and you click through it. Now you get this huge, scary warning and you have to click on all sorts of things and fetch certificates and verify it and so on and so forth. So if you trigger negative feedback, it's really, really bad. If you fail to trigger positive feedback, then it's okay because people don't really notice it. So previously you wanted to spoof SSL. Now it's better to spoof non-SSL. There's the difference. Imagine this on a 1280 by 1024 screen. That is the entire difference between SSL and non-SSL. And as I said, I've blown that up to make it more obvious, but imagine this crammed into the corner of a screen. Another thing is the icon up there, it's called the fav icon, and that's defined by the site. So they've changed the background colour for that icon. The site can actually specify what's in the background colour. So you see the blue background for your icon. It doesn't go quite to the borders, but it's close enough to look pretty much like SSL. And this was demonstrated at Black Hat 2009. It had a 100% success rate. So basically they've degraded standard SSL to the point where it works even less well than it did before. Why do they make these changes? We've got all these studies showing that this doesn't really work and this is a really bad idea. Why were the changes made? If you read through the Mozilla developers list, and you'd have to be pretty keen to do this, I actually went through and printed out all the discussion threads. It's about 100 A4 pages. So you condense that down to book size. You're talking about a fairly sizable textbook on PKI. And, you know, the discussion never goes anywhere. It's sort of, there's all these ideas thrown out, but it's never really resolved. No one has any idea what to do anymore to make this stuff work. So this wasn't the result of any careful planning. It was simply no one had any idea what they could do anymore, and we'll try this and see if it works, because everything else we've tried so far doesn't seem to have worked. So, you know, let's sort of step back a bit and look at why we're in this situation. There's a slide title you've probably never seen before in a security conference. Windows Hardware Qualification Lab is an allegory of commercial PKI. So bear with me, this is relevant. The theory behind WHQL is that you submit them to Microsoft, they qualify them, and then they can sign them or you can sign them, and you've got some degree of quality involved in this. That's the theory. But let's look at graphics cards, for example. It's a really bad market. Gamers, the sort of money makers are gamers, and that's an incredibly fickle market. Whoever gets the biggest numbers, they'll buy that. And so vendors have cheated in benchmarks, and all this stuff is documented. For example, one of the things you could do at one point is rename the DirectX tunnel demo from tunnel.exe to funnel.exe, because the driver recognized the program that was being run. If it was called funnel.exe, it would turn off the cheat mode and run a lot slower. ATI have been caught with this, so you rename Quake. There's a Quake Arena 3, Quake 3 Arena time demo, sorry, and it recognizes that Quake's being run, and the driver turns off some of the rendering options, which you don't notice, but it happens to make it run a lot faster. NVIDIA ran into a problem. They got into a fight with Microsoft over Xbox licensing, and so they didn't have much input into the DirectX 9 spec. So DirectX 9 was heavily influenced by ATI and not influenced at all by NVIDIA, so their performance was really bad when that came out. And they kind of resorted to cheating again with a 3D Mark benchmark. So both of the vendors have cheated. Actually, one of them turned the other in. You want to make your competitors look bad. And you can also see this in action. Take a driver, run it under Windows Driver Verify. This is another way of cheating. And it turns off all the unsafe optimizations and runs like a dog. And you run it outside the Driver Verify and it runs at full speed because the Driver Verify is used to do this qualification stuff. So the thing is, Microsoft knows that this is going on. Some of the stuff actually came from sources inside Microsoft. And the vendors know that Microsoft knows. And Microsoft knows that the vendors know, and so on and so forth. So if everyone knows that this is happening, why doesn't anyone do something about it? Well, the problem is you've got two mutually exclusive goals. The first one is you want to set the bar as low as possible. You want to make sure that every vendor can participate, because if only three people are participating, it's not worth it. On the other hand, you want to also set the bar as high as possible to exclude the bad products. So in a business sense, success is everyone gets to participate. In a quality control sense, success is as few people as possible get to participate. You've got mutually exclusive goals there. So, and that's what happens if you set the bar too high. You've probably seen these. If you've ever installed any hardware under Windows, you will have seen these things. And that's basically the vendors couldn't even pass this minimal bar. So they had to do things like that. And as the middle dialogue shows, it's not just a Windows problem. It happens with other operating systems as well. The thing is, this isn't no-name vendors of, you know, cell phone data cables somewhere. This is a who's who of PC hardware vendors that do this. And some vendors take this even further. This is the problem. Okay, you get the warning dialogues. Well, vendors don't want these warning dialogues, so they'll do things like they'll use Windows user interface automation to actually bypass them. They'll drive the mouse around the screen. And you may have seen this if you run it. If you run installers under a debugger or on a really slow old machine, you can see Windows popping up and the mouse moving around and stuff like that. What they're doing is they're driving the mouse around and dismissing all the warning dialogues and bypassing all the security measures to install the driver for you. And it's kind of spooky. Yeah, run it under a debugger, and you can see all this, the whole machine, there's like this ghost in the machine effect as everything gets changed around. And this is major industry players. This is an extreme example. This is a security software vendor. So what they do is they install their product, they open the Windows control panel, go to system properties, hardware driver signing options, and turn off system-wide driver signing as part of the install of their security software that protects your PC. There's a great quote there from someone at Microsoft. Yeah, when you're faced with something like this, your response is to scream, "Aye!" So, you know, that's the WHKL. That's an example of the dilemma facing commercial CAs. Commercial CAs can be successful in a business sense. So you've got very low barriers to entry. Everyone gets to play. Or they can be successful in a security sense. You've got very high barriers to entry. And you exclude as many dubious people as possible. Well, you know, they're not being run as a hobby. They're going to go for the commercial success, not the security success. And there's some stuff on economic analysis. I tried to analyze this in terms of, you know, sort of economic theory and game theory. And they're just... You can't analyze. I mean, what economic theory predicts is market failure. There's no way to model this in any conventional game theoretic model. I asked a couple of economists. They couldn't figure out any rational way to model this stuff. So, you know, here's another problem. So you've got this thing where pretty much anyone can get in. Well, the problem is we've got the internet, as I mentioned before, this multi-billion dollar cybercrime industry. We've got identities available easily over the internet. So you've got the system designed to defeat identity fraud. Phishing is basically server-side identity fraud. Operating in an environment where you can get any amount of identities with any amount of authentication data you want, the asking the drunk whether he's drunk. And these are some examples of the kind of verification data you want to get. This is usually used directly for financial fraud, but, you know, imagine this applied to a CA to get a certificate. Here's some more examples. Basically, any amount of identity information you want over the internet, you can buy. I don't know how many people are familiar with things like this. This is a place called ScanLab in Russia. Wonderful place. There's a lot of other places that do this. So these will give you any identity documents you want. What they do is they take original passports, not, you know, Photoshop forgeries, but the actual original documents that have been stolen or lost or whatever. They scan the original passport, let's say a US passport, Photoshop out the name. You send them some money and say, I want a passport in this name. I want a, you know, notarized document in this name. I want a certificate of incorporation for this country. And they will send you back this high-resolution scan of a genuine document, just with the name altered, but because it's scanned, you can't see it. And the CA then says, you know, fax us whatever documents you want. So there's some examples, passports, driver's licenses. Pretty much anything a CA would require to get a certificate, you can buy over the internet. So you get your stolen credit card, you get this fake identity document, you send it to the CA, they issue you a certificate. And again, some attempts to model this in economic terms, and it doesn't work. So it's been known for quite some time that CAs will just sell certificates to anyone they want. You know, they think of them as certificate vending machines. They don't really care whose money they take. You give them money, they give you a certificate. It's not a crooked. They're not crooked CAs. If you're charging $9.95 for a certificate, how much checking do you people really expect they're going to do for a $9.95 certificate? The only thing you can do is take the money and hand out a certificate. One of the most recent examples was in 2008. This got some widespread publicity. Previously, it had been small scale. This one was done and then publicized. You know, someone got a certificate from Mozilla.com who was totally unrelated to Mozilla.com. So basically, you can set up a fake Mozilla site and Trojan the browser or put whatever malware you want in the browser. That's a really scary level of attack. You could do a huge amount of damage. The thing is, the CA, the person who pointed this out was a CA employee. Another CA said, well, you know, you guys have done the same thing earlier on. So, this, you know, the CA had done the same thing that they were accusing another CA of doing. So in PKI jargon, this is called a rogue CA, someone who issues certificates to someone who isn't who they claim to be. The scary thing is this could not be revoked. If you revoke that CA certificate, then you have to reissue every certificate that CA has ever issued, which could be hundreds and thousands or even millions of certificates. So technically, there was no way to revoke this in theory, rogue CA certificate. Also, there was such a confusion of CAs and sub-CAs that it took a while to figure out who was even responsible for this, you know, who was to blame for this, because you have CAs that certify sub-CAs, that other CAs, and some of the companies have gone out of business and changed names and swapped owners, so you don't exactly even know who's issuing these things. Okay, SSL certificates, not very good. What about the other major use of certificates, which is code signing certificates? It's actually the same thing. There's been signed malware in circulation for quite some time, and it's been known, again, that at least on a small scale, that this stuff's happening. The first large-scale study was published in 2008. This is Microsoft's Malware Protection Center. So they actually published details based on Windows Defender. So they scanned files, and they looked at stuff that Windows Defender could identify as being malware, and how much of that is digitally signed CA-authenticated malware. I found that 1 in 10 digitally signed applications or programs on a PC was malware that had been at least signed by a CA-authorized certificate. So, you know, Windows comes with a vast amount of drivers built in anyway. This is straight from Microsoft. So that's actually a very scary figure. If you exclude all the Microsoft stuff that's there by default, then what's left is a very significant proportion of all the signed files left on the machine are malware. And these are from legitimate CA-issued certificates. There was, for me, it was 173,000 pieces of digitally signed CA-authenticated malware. Because you go to a CA and you say, you know, I want a certificate. Yeah, here you go. You've now got your code signing certificate. If you look at the risk category, again, this is from Microsoft's figures. The majority of these are in the severe or high-risk category. And there's a neat quote. There's a bunch of quotes like this, but this is a recent one from a World Wide Web consortium. It says that if you sign stuff, it's a guarantee of quality. You know that you're getting quality stuff if it's digitally signed. And you can see that from malware. You're getting high-risk and severe malware if it's digitally signed. So it is an indication of how high quality your malware is that it's digitally signed. And again, as with service certificates, there's basically no accountability. That's, again, a comment from Microsoft that basically of these 173,000 pieces of signed malware, they were able to identify zero authors of them because the CAs, they were vending machines and they didn't really keep track of who they were issuing these certs to. There's a whole bunch of stories circulating about these sort of outrageous conditions under which some of these certificates get issued. You know, you want a high assurance Vista code signing certificate and you're a panel beater. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Here you go. The scary thing about this is, you know, whenever you tell some of these stories, there's always someone who stands up later and says, you think that's bad, listen to this one. And then there's an even worse story like this. So I'll leave this for now. This is sort of the final word on PKI authentication. There's a thing called, it used to be called the PKI Workshop. It's now called the ID Trust Workshop. It's a premier PKI conference. So if you're a PKI expert and PKI enthusiast and you're going to a PKI conference, that's how you authenticate yourself for the conference. Okay, so I'll stop bashing PKI for a minute and get onto something else. So, you know, you've got the PKI thing, and then there's people like SSH. They say, well, we don't use PKI. SSH is okay. We don't do any of that rubbish, so we're safe. Well, some background on this. If you use SSH, you'll be familiar with this. If you don't use SSH, basically you connect to the server. If it's a key that server you've never seen before, a key you've never seen before, you get this fingerprint, and the software remembers it for future use. The idea is you verify the fingerprint, which means you verify the key, and you can then tell whether it's a legitimate key or not. PKI people call this leap of faith authentication. SSH people call it functional authentication, and then they throw pies at each other. So there's this thing called fuzzy fingerprints, and this is kind of cool. What you do is you repeatedly generate server keys. So if you generate a proper, secure RSA key, it takes quite a bit of time. If you just want to generate them as quickly as possible, it's little more than an addition operation and part of a hash. They're not very strong keys, but you don't care. You just want to generate a fake one. And what this fuzzy fingerprint stuff does is it gives extra weighting to the shapes of the letters. So you're not going for the closest match in hex digits. You're going for the closest visual match. So this is that's the original, and that's the fuzzy fingerprint match. I'll just flip back and forth a couple of times between this. It's reasonably close, and this defeats pretty much any kind of SSH authentication. Most people memorize the first one or two digits and the last one or two digits, and that's about it, because you can't memorize 40 hex digits. So I wanted to test this. How effective are fuzzy fingerprint attacks? So I went to two large organizations, one in New Zealand, one in the US, each with thousands and thousands of computer literate users. And I wanted to determine what the base rate was. So if you change the fingerprint to a totally unrelated fingerprint, how many people will notice that? And so I asked the IT folks, you know, if in previous times when you've rolled over keys, how many people have emailed you or walked into your office or phoned you or done anything at all whenever the key changed to do this required out-of-band authentication? And the answer was none, ever. So if the base rate for totally different fingerprints is already zero, then fuzzy fingerprints can't really make it that much worse. So I propose this as a conference paper. If anyone's ever doing a very short workshop on security, then I'll publish this one. So basically the conclusion is, you know, we've got the defenders saying we're going to throw crypto at it, we're going to follow an arbitrary set of best practices or whatever. And what was the problem again that we were defending against? It doesn't matter, we're throwing crypto at it, we're safe. The attackers, on the other hand, they look at the problem, well, that's kind of obvious stuff. So, yeah, for the defenders, two-step recovery program. First of all, admit you have a problem. Admit that best practices are sometimes absolutely worst practices. And secondly, switch to the attacker strategy, which is, you know, what problem are we solving? And then take a specific solution tailored to solve that problem rather than just following arbitrary rules. There's a huge bunch of, you know, there's a number of studies and surveys and so on behind this, and I've got a draft publication. This it's not a public URL. It shouldn't end up on Slashdot or something, but it does have background material on there discussing some of this and also discussing solutions. It would be a 4 or 5 hour talk if I went into some of the proposed solutions, but there's a chapter on PKI and SSH, what I've covered here, in a chapter called Problems, and there's a discussion of passwords in a chapter called Passwords. And an extreme example also in the first chapter is an extreme example of designing a solution to fit a particular problem versus simply throwing crypto at it and declaring victory. Okay, thanks. Thank you.